The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Here we are in Media Matters today. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. And this is, our fifth week now we've been on the air here on WILL 580 in beautiful Urbana. And today, for the first time, we're going to have two guests join us, two very special guests, to talk about the state of journalism in the United States today. And these are two very well-known and accomplished journalists. The first one is Trudy Lieberman, who will be joining us from her home in New York, and very graciously, I might say, joining us on Mother's Day. And Trudy Lieberman is the director of the Center for Consumer Health Choices at the Consumer Union and a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. She's won two National Magazine Awards and 10 National Press Club Awards for her work. Her most recent book is Slanting the Story, The Forces That Shape the News, published by New Press just in the year 2000. Trudy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Once again, thank you very much for joining us on Mother's Day of all days.
Thank you.
And giving us your time. Also with us on the line from California is Norman Solomon, a syndicated columnist who I think is well known to many of our listeners. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and he writes a column, Media Beat, which is syndicated, carried in the San Francisco Examiner and many other daily papers. Norman's ninth book, The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media, was published in 1999 by Common Courage Press. Norman, are you there?
I am. Hey, it's good to be with you.
It's wonderful to be with you. Now, I've got to say, as an editorial admission, that Norman and I are good friends, so no one thinks that we're just faking it here, and also that I'm on the board of his group, the Institute for Public Accuracy, which he founded, 5 years ago, Norman?
That's right.
And before we get started, Norman, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Institute for Public Accuracy, because it really pertains to a lot of what Trudy's written about in her work.
Yeah, well, actually, it was somewhat inspired, I could use the word advisedly, but inspired by a visit I paid to the Heritage Foundation as a columnist about 6 years ago, and I couldn't help but notice the incredible energy and resources they put into putting out their perspectives to news media and making various researchers and analysts available to TV and radio and so forth. So I thought we could kind of take a page from their playbook and, albeit with about 1% of their budget, go ahead and try to offer progressive-minded policy researchers and analysts to particularly TV and radio talk shows. So about 5 years ago, we did found the Institute for Public Accuracy, which, by the way, is on the web at accuracy.org. And since then, we've been functioning as a consortium of public policy experts. You know, we don't have the money to have them on staff, but there are more than 1,000 folks who are in our database who at various times were able to offer to media to comment and analyze the news of the day.
The theory basically being that conservatives have had a chance to really influence the news by offering all sorts of experts and sources to journalists, and that this would be a chance to offer other perspectives. A journalist covering a story on Deadline wouldn't simply have to rely on the same tired suspects in their Rolodex. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, what's passed so often for debate has been fairly narrow-ranging, and so we thought that it was really crucial to begin to concertedly widen those bounds of discourse.
You know, now a lot of people listening to the show already, Media Matters, and I'm the host, Bob McChesney, a lot of people listening to the show are probably having disconnect. They're saying, gee whiz, you're talking about conservatives dominating news or having a strategy so they influence it as strongly, when in fact if you turn on the MSNBC or CNBC or Fox News Channel, what you're constantly hearing is the argument about how liberal the news media are, how strongly they project liberal values and fight for left-wing liberal causes. A recent book by Bernard Goldberg, I think,
right,
called Bias, made that case eloquently, jumped to the top of the bestseller list. Even President Bush was seen carrying a copy under his arm, though what exactly he was doing with the book was never clarified. Trudy Lieberman, you wrote the book, Slanting the Story, The Forces That Shape the News. I mean, this book, in my view, basically goes directly at the argument that we have a liberal bias media to talk on the ground about what's happening to the media. Can you just tell our listeners, please, you know, in brief, what your book is about, what you claim?
Well, I didn't find any liberal bias in the media during the years that I studied, which were the early 90s, really up until 96, 97, and into 98. I took four case studies and looked in depth at how the right wing and how groups like the Heritage Foundation and other conservative think tanks and organizations and their funders really moved their agenda to the top of our national politics. The four that I looked at were Medicare, how the right wing began to chip away at Medicare as a social insurance program and began to substitute its own version of what Medicare should look like, which is more of a private, which they would like is more of a private system, a voucher system, if you will, in which the government would give every beneficiary a set amount of money and tell them to go out and buy insurance in the private market. And if the money was not sufficient, as it will not be over time, because we all know what's happening to medical care costs, the beneficiary would have to dig into his or her own pocket and make up the difference. The other case studies that I looked at were, one was on the Food and Drug Administration and how the right wing and many of its allies in the biotech industry were able to change the FDA law to be more to their liking. The third one that I looked at was the case of AARP and how AARP eventually got...
AARP, for our listeners' sake, is the...
The American Association of Retired Persons.
Okie dokie.
I believe they call themselves AARP now.
Okay.
How they essentially were neutered in the debate over Medicare and Social Security privatization. And the fourth one was on the Cato Institute's work on Head Start. And this is one that they didn't really succeed on. They began in 1993 to take money out of the Head Start budget, and instead the Clintons, largely through Hillary's work, championed Head Start. And Head Start ended up getting a lot more money. But the other issues have had very profound effects on the way people think about these particular issues.
We're talking with Trudy Lieberman and Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. If you'd like to call in, the number here for local calls is 333-9455. For toll-free calls, the number is 1-800-222-9455. I think anything goes with these guests. If you want to talk about journalism, the state of the press today, in current times and the effect on politics, I think we've got two wonderful guests who can address that. Now, Trudy Lieberman, when you say the right wing made concerted efforts to change the nature of coverage, to influence the public policymaking process through the media, I mean, how did this take place? Did they, like, did, you know, some rich guy march into a newsroom and say, start covering it this way? I mean, what was the strategic way that they went about this?
Oh, no, it's far more subtle than that. Many of these organizations are funded by a number of conservative foundations that have a lot of money. And these organizations have not been afraid to put money into ideological causes, as opposed to a number of foundations on the left or the more progressive foundations that kind of shy away from ideological issues. Instead, these organizations put money into think tanks for very explicit purposes, and that's to influence the media and change the public perception of a number of these issues. And Norman alluded to some of their techniques earlier, where they would put together a stable of experts on a particular topic, say Social Security privatization or Medicare or taxes or welfare reform or trade policy. It goes on and on. And make these experts readily available to the media. In addition, they often had briefings for the press and often took people to lunch. Many of these are sort of tried and true activities, but they did them, and they did them very well. And after a while, many of the members of the media started embracing their own truths as the ones that they were going to write about, as particularly in economic areas. The issues that I'm talking about are not social ones like abortion or racial relations. I'm talking about economic pocketbook issues primarily. So that's one of the techniques that they used, and I'm thinking in particular of the Heritage Foundation actually bombarding the media with study after study and issue brief after issue brief and press release after press release on the Medicare debate in 1995, 96, and 97, because I got all of these messages, and there was one right after another, and after a while, people began to think, yeah, maybe that's the way things really are. So they were very persistent and very good at what they did.
And on the other side, there was nothing anywhere near as well organized and well funded, providing the alternative view for journalists to work with.
No, certainly there are studies that come from groups on the left. I don't mean to suggest that there are not. But the persistence with which they attack an issue is simply not there. It's just not there in the same way. And you don't get the feeling as a journalist that, you know, they're as passionate about their cause as those on the right are.
We're talking with Trudy Lieberman, the author of Slanting the Story, The Forces That Shape the News, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in, our number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Also with us on the line from California, syndicated columnist and author Norman Solomon. Norman, you've written a lot about the so-called liberal media bias that we hear constantly, that the media have a liberal bias. What's your take on this argument?
Well, I think it's notable that the myth of the liberal media has been largely propagated by the mass media themselves. And so it's kind of a buzz phrase for indicating that media are, coming from the left, whatever that means, too critical of corporate power and capitalism. And there's also the kind of culture wars implication that they're too sympathetic to gay rights and civil rights and affirmative action and women's rights and on and on. And I think it's notable that the mass media themselves have really promoted this concept, which should be a warning flag about the authenticity of the that supposed concern in terms of it being grounded in reality. Also, I think we need to kind of take apart the word liberal because it has so much ambiguity built into it. For instance, when you look at who owns the major media outlets, you're looking at huge multi-billion-dollar firms on Wall Street. You're looking at AOL Time Warner and General Electric and Viacom and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp and Gannett. And the notion that somehow these very large corporations would somehow be opposed to the bedrock corporate economic relations in the country, I think really strains credulity, and yet somehow it's being propagated and I think believed to a large extent. There also are a lot of empirical measures, and one of them would be to look at which of these think tanks are actually being used, quoted, cited, and given airtime and ink.
And you've done research on that, haven't you, Norman?
Well, the Media Watch Group FAIR has done a series of annual reports with pretty rigorous searches of Nexus Media databases. And Michael Dolny, the sociologist, published his latest in a series in the March-April 2002 edition of Extra, the magazine of the Media Watch Group FAIR. And they found that among the top most cited and utilized think tanks last year, there wasn't a single progressive or what we would call left-leaning think tank within the top 10. You know, it begins with the Brookings Institution, which is very centrist, sometimes mislabeled as liberal, even though increasingly Republicans have run the organization. Then you've got Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, and onward from there. So these are very much pro-corporate on the whole institutions, very much in favor of existing economic relations, tilting more towards policies that would be furtherly advantageous to the wealthy and large corporations. And they're dominant quite empirically in terms of measuring who's getting time on the air and in print.
Let me jump in here for a second, Bob.
Please do, Trudy.
The one thing that I discovered when I was doing research for my book is that the notion of the liberal media is often used as a fundraising tactic by these organizations. Because I would get a number of mailings from them, and they would use that as a way to generate money from donors out in the country. And when I ask a number of people on the right about, well, really, is there a liberal media here? And they'd say, oh, not really, but it's worth perpetuating this idea because it's worth a lot of money to them to keep doing that. And I think another thing that we have to think about is who has the power here. It's not just a matter of getting the name in the media, which is important, certainly, and certainly the right is dominating the mere mentions, but many of these organizations have far more power and far more clout on the Hill through various Congress people and so forth. And I think we have to think about that as well, because it's not just a matter of getting quoted in the media and working on that. We've got to think about who really has the power here.
You know, on that note, too, actually, Trudy, I wanted to ask you about a couple of statements that I just read.
Hey, Norman, this is my show. What are you doing?
There are a couple of things in particular that really, even given what the mass media tend to put out in terms of commentary, it really blew my mind to read a piece by somebody who's considered to be, you know, the dean of American political journalism, David Broder. Last Wednesday, he wrote a piece in the Washington Post that was basically hosannas of praise for two think tanks celebrating their quarter-century anniversaries, Heritage Foundation and Cato Institute. And he starts out by calling them two of Washington's great dissenters on the right. And I thought, how could a major political reporter refer in particular to the Heritage Foundation as a dissenter in Washington when, of course, you know, they wrote the Mandate for Leadership report that was the blueprint for the Reagan administration, and even though they have some tiffs with right-wing White House administration since then, they hardly seem to qualify as dissenters, and yet Broder here is praising on and on these two outfits as though they are the lifeblood of democracy without expressing any concern that we don't have any comparable voices with access to the halls of media or journalistic or government power in Washington from a progressive vantage point.
Well, I think that just tells you how far they've come in terms of their penetration of the mainstream media.
You know,
it's an example of that.
You know, I think, Trudy, is either in your book or something you wrote, Norman, and I've read both of them, that there was some discussion about how since the 1980s into the present day, that originally when Heritage and American Enterprise Institute sources were used, they were always flagged as conservative Heritage Foundation or conservative AEI source. And then over time, this sort of conservative drops. And pretty soon they're just sort of neutral expert sources on all subjects. Is one of you familiar with that?
Yeah, I mentioned that, I think, in my book. And I think it cuts both ways because lots of times the media is pretty sloppy about how they identify various groups. This was particularly true during healthcare reform in 93, 94, where a lot of groups were writing op-eds and the writers were not identified and their credentials were kind of hidden. I think that some papers are paying a little bit more attention to this, but I would guess that if we were to do a survey right now, a random survey of newspapers across the country, we might find an awful lot of sloppiness going on. My point is that any group ought to be identified with its particular ideological inclination, whether it is on the right or on the left, because the reader or listener deserves an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And they deserve to understand. And often that we'll see on television particularly is just the label expert. An expert in welfare reform or an expert in city finance or whatever, and that expert is never really identified.
That's a great point.
What his or her ideological underpinnings are. And I think from the public's point of view, that's very deceptive because they really don't know how to judge what they're hearing.
We're talking today on Media Matters with Trudy Lieberman, who you just listened to, author of Slanting the Story, The Forces That Shape the News, and Norman Solomon, syndicated columnist and author of The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media. If you'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment, the number is 333-9455. For local numbers, the toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455, and our lines are open, so feel free to call in and have a wonderful chance to talk to both Trudy or Norman about what's going on in media. Now, as I listen to both of you talk, it occurs to me that since a lot of this sort of conservative foundation assault or effort, strategy toward media really began in the 70s and took off in the 80s and 90s, That suggests then that back before the 80s, say, our journalism was a lot better, more balanced, perhaps. Is that, what do you think? Is that a fair assessment, Trudy?
You know, it's hard to say. One of the critiques of my book, was a very cogent critique, actually, was that I was pining for the good old days of journalism in the 60s and 70s, and the reviewer pointed out that journalism really wasn't so great in those days, and I think possibly that's correct. I think in the old days, at least there was some attempt to put things in more of a context. And there was somewhat more willingness on the part of the media itself to write about some things that are very difficult to write about now. Mm-hmm. I started my career as a consumer reporter at the Detroit Free Press, and for a while had a fair amount of freedom to kind of gore a lot of oxes. And there was a more of a willingness on the part of newspapers to do that. And that's changed a lot as papers have become more money-driven, and compensation of editors has been tied to the bottom line. And I think that certainly is one change. But I think that in reaction to what we saw in, say, the Nader heyday of the late 60s, mid-60s, say through the mid-70s, we saw a corporate reaction to that taking place. And we had the formation of the Business Roundtable and other activities on the part of corporate America to kind of fight back. It's not that they really needed to fight back too much, but they perceived that they did. And through that organization and that fighting back, we have these other think tanks that have grown out of that movement and have what we have now. And I always say that the corporations and these groups turned Naderism on its head and began to use some of the techniques that Nader used to kind of write the balance between corporate power and public interest.
Something I'd add is that in the last few decades, certain beats have almost disappeared on daily newspapers. For instance, the labor beat barely exists, even on large dailies. Consumer reporting is not what it was, at least as we used to think of it. It's now more news you can use, promotional, what the best gadgets are and services, et cetera, et cetera. If you talk to someone like Morton Mintz, who used to do very vigorous enterprise investigative reporting on consumer and drug safety issues for the Washington Post, he will tell you that the Post isn't nearly as aggressive on those issues, and I think he's correct. But meanwhile, we've had this great upsurge in letting daily newspapers serve as essentially bulletin boards for corporate America, with entire sections devoted not just to stock market quotes, but features and news on the latest trials and tribulations of CEOs and investors, and really reporting on the economic sphere from the vantage point of those who invest and manage and own, more really than consumers. And the net result of that shift, I think, is to move towards more of an ideological base that is unfettered, so-called free market, where in reality some of the assumptions are simply unexamined and much more to the liking of corporate top executives.
Well, I think we don't have to look too much further than the 401k plan as an example of this, Norman. I think that the 401k plan came about in the early 80s and was extolled as the way the little man could guide his investments to have a very rich retirement. And while this was going on, the corporations began little by little getting rid of their defined benefit pension plans, the Cadillac of pensions that provide a constant defined benefit to people in retirement, a stable benefit. And people don't have that anymore, and the few companies that have them are thinking of ways to get rid of them. But what we had here is the coverage of the 401k plan was turned around not as something that really might hurt people in the long run, but something that was going to be wonderful for people. And if you think about how much money people actually have in 401k plans today, and then think about annuitizing this for a period of 20 or even 30 years into retirement, people aren't going to have a whole lot of money. And it's that context, I think, that's really missing.
You know, right now, if we can, I've got to break in because it's the bottom of the hour. And here in Illinois, when it's this time of year, we have to have weather updates every 30 minutes. So we're going to go to a quick weather update in our Weather Central.
The National Weather Service has issued flash flood warnings for the following counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area. In Illinois, Cumberland and Clark counties until 2 p.m., Christian, Macon, and Sangamon counties until 4 p.m., Champaign and Vermilion counties until 5 p.m., and Coles, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, Piatt, and Shelby counties until 6 p.m., Vigo County in Indiana until 1:45 p.m., and Fountain Park and Vermilion counties in Indiana until 2:15 p.m. A flash flood warning means flooding is imminent or occurring. A flood watch continues today for Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties in Illinois and Benton County in Indiana, and through tomorrow morning in Fountain Park, Vermilion, Vigo, and Warren counties in Indiana.
Welcome back to Media Matters today on WILL 580 in beautiful Urbana. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our guests today are Trudy Lieberman and Norman Solomon. Trudy Lieberman's the author of Slanting the Story, The Forces That Shape the News. Norman Solomon, the author of The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media and a well-known syndicated columnist. We're all here talking today about the state of the media and the influence of business, think tanks, and conservatives to shape the nature of the news media. If you'd like to call in, we have lines open. The local number is 333-9455. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Lines open, plenty of time. And I'd like to go back to what we've just been talking about. You know, some people would argue, to play the devil's advocate for a second, that this is actually, there's nothing wrong with this, that business interests are just doing what anyone would do in a free society, and that other interests can do what Norman Solomon's group, the Institute for Public Accuracy, is doing and try to play the same game. But, you know, if they don't participate, that's their own fault, but we get the media we deserve. What do you think of that, Norman?
Well, if you want a playing field where the terrain is really shaped by money, you know, then it is the best democracy that money can buy. But the at least theoretical precepts of democracy include that everybody has a voice and there's some kind of participation and access to the First Amendment in real terms across the board. You know, I'm afraid that in practice we have something much more akin to a First Half Amendment where we have freedom to speak. Everybody has that, but far, far from equal freedom to be heard. It's as though if you were put in solitary confinement for the next 50 years, the claim could be made that there's nothing wrong with that because you have freedom to speak, but whether it's only to speak to the walls rather than to be heard is a whole other matter. So I think it's a different, there are competing notions here to what democracy in practice would really entail.
Well, I think there's two other things going on here. One is the notion of self-censorship. Many of our colleagues in the media, and probably we've done it too in our career, is decide what we know will get published and only pursue those things that are going to result in stories, knowing that there might be five or six other things on the back burner that kind of address some of these larger, more important questions, but we know that they're going to get shot down. So there's a whole lot of self-censorship going on here. Then there's also the issue about who gets on these programs and what can you say. There's one friend of mine who gets on to talk about Medicare from time to time, and I always kid her about not straying too far off the reservation, and she tells me that she knows exactly what she can say and what she can't say. And another friend of mine who is from one of the think tanks said that she was asked to go on a show on PBS once, and in the pre-interview, she told them that she didn't think that you had to reform Medicare in order to get people prescription drug benefit, and that is not the line that they wanted to pursue. They wanted somebody to say, yes, you need to do wholesale reform in order to get people a prescription drug benefit. The two don't necessarily go together, and she was absolutely right, but because she took that position, she didn't get on the show.
Well, I've really had, you know, from personal experience, had both of those sort of things happen. I know I had a book out called The Power of Babel about 10 years ago about use of political rhetoric, and I was pre-interviewed and seemed to be to the final stage of getting green light to be on the program Fresh Air. And the salient problem seemed to be, though, I was asked if I had a political perspective on this or whether it was simply linguistic. And when I said I had a political perspective, that seemed to be to tear it, and I was invited on. On the other hand, I was on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer a couple of times in the year 2000 talking about media coverage of political issues. And while I don't really talk about it in public, but since it's come up, you know, after I was on the second time live, I got a note from a producer at the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer saying that they were very disappointed that I had politicized our roundtable discussion of coverage of the Democratic Convention. And so, you know, I think you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a social scientist or even particularly a perceptive journalist to understand that if you don't give the producers what they want on these major talk shows, it's a real disincentive for them to invite you back.
We're talking with Norman Solomon, you just heard, and Trudy Lieberman today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a caller I want to get to in a second. In the meantime, I want to urge you, if you'd like to call in, the number 333-9455 locally or 1-800-222-9455. So let's go to the lines now. Line one from Champaign, you're on the air. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. She brought up the best democracy money can buy. I've been, in fact, reading Greg Palast's book by that same title, and I mean, it seems things have gotten incredibly bad with the media here when, you know, a journalist writing for the BBC and The Guardian, the London paper The Guardian, has to break a story that he's investigated that shows how the Republican Party has stolen the presidential election in Florida. And, I mean, even the Democrats seem to, you know, just roll over and die. They're not even going to pick the ball up and you know, have the gumption to fight back about this.
I mean, well, I think you make a key point.
And if the, you know, lack of media coverage, that they're not going to make an issue out of it?
Well, I think a good rule of thumb in looking at what becomes a big national political issue is when there's no significant division between or within the Democratic and Republican parties nationally, it's very difficult to get major U.S. national media coverage on it as a significant issue. And what happened in Florida that Greg Palast covered for British outlets is a case in point, because the Gore campaign made a decision very early on after the polls closed in early November that racism was not going to be their cutting-edge issue. They wanted to talk about hanging chads and so forth and butterfly ballots. They didn't want to talk about the purging of tens of thousands of African-American men from the voting rolls illegitimately on the pretext, usually or often incorrect, that they were felons who didn't have the right to vote. And so in the absence of the Democratic Party campaign raising institutionalized racism in that context as cutting edge, the national media simply did not on their own find it proper to go ahead and raise it as a key issue themselves.
Trudy, did you want to add anything to that?
No, but just I didn't really follow, as a journalist, follow what was going on in Florida, but I did follow it as a consumer of news at the time, and I always had the feeling that I really wasn't getting the whole story, that there were questions that would come up as I was sort of listening, and they were not being answered. So I guess as a viewer, a reader, I just kept thinking I was getting what they wanted me to hear.
Mm-hmm. Once again, we're talking to Norman Solomon and Trudy Lieberman. We've got some lines open, and we've got a caller we're going to get to in a second. The number here is 333-9455, or our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Line two from the highway on a cell phone. You're on the air.
Brigade instructor, this is one of your ex-students.
All right.
And perhaps in time you'll recognize the voice. But I have the question I have to direct to you and your esteemed guest is that, as I recall from the speech comm, whatever it was, 2-0-something or other class I had with you, is in the past, many newspapers and, well, newspapers, which were the prime media outlets, say, of the 18th, 19th century, were in fact house organs of various groups and biased organizations and so on and so forth. And so, and I don't approve of that in any way, and I don't approve of what you're talking about now, you know, the bias. But in a way, isn't this just sort of, you know, new age free press? It's a new incarnation of an old thing. And I'll hang up and get your response.
Okay. Thank you very much. Maybe I can paraphrase it. If you don't mind, I'll take the professor's prerogative here. Norman, I mean, is this, or Trudy, both of you each have a crack at this, is this just old-fashioned partisan journalism, more of the same, and a long-standing tradition? How should we characterize this? Is this maybe not that big of a deal?
Well, clearly the styles have changed over the decades as well as the technologies, and the belief now is that if you attribute things on the hard news accounts, say on the front page, if it's attributed, then you're not being biased, whereas maybe 100 years ago it was clearly an editorial on the front pages. Now who is quoted in those news stories determines the spin, although it may sound very even-handed. So the underlying ownership or orientation certainly makes a difference. I think in some ways journalism has improved in terms of the news coverage. It's not so overtly heavy-handed, but I think the biases are more insidious. And you know, one other thing I'd say is that while the consolidation of media ownership is now more extreme, you know, and Ben Bagdikian's documented in the sixth edition of his book, The Media Monopoly, that there are now about five or six corporations that through ownership control most of the news and information flow in the United States, the ownership of media has always tilted the major outlets towards the interests of the wealthy and consolidated capital. And, you know, one example would be to go back to the accounts that the great journalist and media critic George Saldus gives of his entry-level positions in the press of Pittsburgh way early in the 20th century. And it was only long afterwards that he found out that many of those newspapers in Pittsburgh were owned by the same man, even though they seemed to be competing entities.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing that's changed, and certainly journalism education has fostered this from the days of, I mean, an improvement over the days of yellow journalism at the beginning of the 20th century. We have objectivity and balance, and these are very basic tenets of journalism that every person who goes through a journalism program at a major university learns. However, I would argue that that sort of has changed a bit and actually furthers the rights agenda at the moment. We have what we like to call he said, she said journalism. And this is something that has really become very evident in the last decade or two, I would say. We have the top of the story, whoever is making the news, whether it's a new study from whatever think tank or whatever organization, and then we have rebuttal at the end. And I particularly saw this technique when I was looking at the coverage of the change in the regulatory authority for the Food and Drug Administration. There were a lot of phony studies and funny kinds of public relations activities used to capture media attention. Of course, they were always the lead of the story. And then at the end of the story, they went to usually Sid Wolf, one of the Nader people, to talk about, well, why isn't this good? So by the time somebody gets to the bottom of the story, there may be a rebuttal, and sometimes there wasn't much of a rebuttal. And I would argue, as well as some other journalism professors would argue, that the he said, she said form of journalism now sometimes doesn't get at the truth very well. You have these dueling quotes, and somehow the reader is supposed to figure out what all of this means without any context. And as news holes have been shrinking, there's not a lot of room for the reporter to kind of expand on these and say why a quote may not be particularly relevant, or, you know, somebody has his quote, but it may be wrong, and maybe they need some more explanation to understand how it fits. That's what's missing today. The truth is far more complex on many of these issues than just the quotes.
Trudy, as you make your argument in your book and today on the show, you know, part of it seems clearly to be that conservative think tanks have aggressively and effectively slanted the news, shaped the news to suit their own political agenda. But you've also alluded to a second issue that seems related to which Norman's talked about also, the increasing corporate concentration, the pressure on journalism and editors to generate immediate profit from their work. I mean, are these two closely related? Are they separate phenomena? I mean, how would, when you sort of try to figure it out, how do you rank order them or relate them?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Certainly the corporate pressures are pretty paramount today, and I think every journalist will tell you that. when I started in the business in the late 60s, one was not so aware of that. I mean, you sort of always knew at the back of your mind that the owners of the press really do control what is seen in the media. But, you know, there was a little bit more willingness to tolerate stories and some challenges to that kind of thinking. But not so much now.
Mm-hmm.
It's much different.
Well, you know, Norman, I'd like to switch gears just a little bit, if we can, and turn to the present day, because you've written a series of columns in the past year on the current war on terrorism, on the Bush administration, on international politics. And, you know, currently President Bush enjoys a spectacular approval rate, apparently, based on the polls, historically quite high. Some would argue that, you know, this means the news media should treat him generously. The people like him, he should be treated, you know, charitably and favorably to reflect the will of the people. And that if he had low ratings, the media should then go after him. What's your assessment of how the press has handled Bush and how they should handle him?
Well, I think a big difference between those who are really fighting for a tough, independent press and those who just want to have flackery for Republicans or Democrats is whether there's an independent and consistent call for tough questions to be asked of any president, no matter who he, and it has been he so far, happens to be. And what we've had really is an enormous amount of fawning of stenography instead of journalism for the president, especially since September 11th. And there are exceptions. You know, you can find particular editorials, for instance, the Daytona Beach News Journal has been very tough on the repressive aspects of the anti-civil liberties policies post-September 11th of the Bush administration. And there are some other media outlets that have as well. But, you know, any ad exec knows that the essence of propaganda is repetition when the same code words, catchphrases, and assumptions are repeated endlessly. And I think particularly since 9/11, we've had this just automatic assumption with few exceptions in the media that there's something called the war on terrorism. It is good and righteous. The precepts of it shouldn't be, you know, questioned in any fundamental way. And I think that we are at this point largely in an Orwellian zone, because the war on terrorism has been even shortened to the war on terror, which I've come to believe is maybe one of the most demagogic terms that the news media have used in this country in many years, which is saying something. I mean, how do you have a government that's using high-tech weapons that inevitably have caused terror among a lot of people, for instance, in Afghanistan? How do you call that a war on terror? I mean, how do you engage in a war on terror by terrorizing people? Now, you could argue that it's, quote-unquote, worth it, just as Madeleine Albright argued to very little media criticism on 60 Minutes in 1996 that it was worth it to take the lives of 500,000 Iraqi children by spearheading continued sanctions on that country and taking all those lives, and she said it's worth it. But what the news media don't do in general is to bring those arguments or assumptions out into the open, put a fine point on them, and talk about the human cost. So just overall, I would say that the media coverage of the so-called war on terrorism in the last 8 months or so has been much closer to a fourth branch of government approach. It's not a fourth estate approach, and it does much more to rubber stamp, albeit with some grousing, U.S. foreign policy, than to serve the kind of interest that an independent press are supposed to serve.
I'd like to point out the contrast between the way the media went after Clinton and the kind of questioning that was done over and over about relatively insignificant issues about his sexual activities and the whole Whitewater issue that turned out to be nothing, compared to the issues that Norman just raised. And I think that we don't have the press in the aggressive mode that you could say that it was in during the Clinton years. And the stakes are far higher.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Trudy Lieberman and Norman Solomon today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a caller I'm going to get to in a second. I'd like to remind you, we have about 10 minutes left, and there we can get another call or two, and that's the one I'm going to turn to in a second. So the number is 333-9455, or the toll-free number 800-222-9455. We've got a caller from Champaign. Hi, you're on the air with Norman and Trudy.
Hi. Since Norman moved the subject to international politics, it sort of segues into what I wanted to ask about, which is, it seems to me that in recent times we've heard a lot about the European media and its, in terms of the Middle East, its anti-Israeli and pro-Palestinian biases. And I wondered if you would talk about that and how the European media and the American media are similar or different, and especially in terms of foreign policy and various other matters. Thank you.
Well, I'd start off just by commenting about the British press, which is I'm most familiar with in terms of European outlets, and that is that there are routinely reports in major British media that I can't imagine, for instance, in the New York Times or Washington Post or on NPR News, the kind of commentary on the scene that comes from, say, Robert Fisk in Pakistan or Afghanistan or the Middle East, I just can't imagine running on a regular basis in the Times or the Post as it does in the Independent based in London, or Greg Palast, who we've heard mention of, who's on the BBC regularly and reports for the Observer newspaper in London. These are folks that get their facts right. They have a slant, just as the front page of the New York Times has a slant, but they essentially are persona non grata in the U.S. mass media. And likewise, the kind of reporting that the BBC radio does on the Middle East, I believe, is far more even-handed than NPR News, which is not always, but I think routinely, overwhelmingly, portraying and viewing the events of the Middle East through the eyes of, say, Israel, rather than a more multifaceted approach.
Trudy, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, sometimes I wonder if there is another side. I mean, I don't see the Arab side being portrayed with the same intensity.
Mm-hmm. We're on Media Matters. We've got time for calls. We've got another caller on the line right now. Line 2 from the highway. Yet another cell phone. You're on the air with Norman and Trudy.
I really enjoy your show. Thank you very much. My question is there a good source, a website, that explains the bias or the slant of the various foundations and sources that are sometimes quoted on the op-ed pages? And
well, that's a great question. Norman, I know that you've already mentioned that your website is accuracy.org, and you've mentioned FAIR, the group Fairness in Action Reporting, and its website is FAIR, FAIR.org. Can you think of some others?
Well, those are the two that pop to mind. I mean, FAIR.org publishes regular studies on bias of news media coverage, most recently about Fox, and also studies of think tanks. But I'd recommend some other outlets, like MediaChannel.org is very good, international in scope. And also, you'll get de facto a lot of media criticism if you go to places like Alternet.org or commondreams.org.
And Trudy, I think it's fair to point out that Columbia Journalism Review has an excellent website for people interested in these issues. Do you know what their web address is offhand? I won't tell your boss.
Maybe I can get it for you, though.
I think it's like just cjr.org. I think it's...
Let me just pull an issue here, and I can probably find it for you.
This is live radio. This is great. We can look... Oh, it is. It's www.cjr.org.
Yep.
My crack producer, Ben Scott,
threw
that up in the computer.
Yep.
And that has a lot of great material on it as well. And I might say, and I'm not here to talk, my website, which is just myname.com, robertmcchesney.com, lists everything on earth I've found that would help someone try to get information about news media and media coverage.
Certainly the notes in my book, Slanting the Story, The Forces That Shape the News, have lots of footnotes, references to studies done by progressive organizations that deal with a number of these think tanks and the money that they get and their ideological slant.
And while I'm at it, I'd like to mention, before you buy Trudy's book, you may want to go to tompaine.com, Trudy.com, because they excerpted extensively some of Trudy's book. It was really excellent that they did so, and people could get a taste by going to that website and checking the archives.
That's correct. The excerpts were about a year ago.
Okay. We're talking to Norman Solomon and Trudy Lieberman today on Media Matters. You know, we've only got about 5 minutes left. We've got another caller I want to get back to in a second. But first, you know, one of the logical things I think that people listening to this show are going to say is, well, you know, what can we do about this? I mean, you know, you're depressing me. We're finding out we can't trust the news that on fundamental issues of taxes, regulation, equality in our society, the news is warped to suit the interests of those who have the most money. What would you recommend someone, what can they take from this and try to actively do to change it? Norman, Trudy, why don't you take a crack at that?
Well, I think skepticism is necessary but not sufficient, and we need to be critical at all times. I mean, I kind of use the metaphor of a radar screen to track unidentified flying propaganda, and it's a radar screen, so to speak, that we need all the time. But I think we also need tools. We've talked about some of the websites people can go to. And I think we need to cut against the usual grain of passivity towards media. We need to get involved in media activism, whether it's joining up with a group like FAIR, but also going ahead and in our own communities identifying problems and dealing with the need to organize to challenge dominance of news media by certain interests.
I think we need to be very skeptical, good consumers of news, just the way we might be good consumers if we were going to buy a car or a television set. If we were making those kind of purchases, we'd probably study various publications, we'd probably read, we'd probably ask a lot of questions of the salespeople. And I think when it comes to the news as a commodity, which it is, people are not asking those same kinds of questions. And I think it's going to take a lot of questioning and a lot of agitation to change this, because what you hear from media types, particularly editors and publishers, is that we're giving people what they want. And if we are indeed giving people what they want, that's one thing, but we may not be.
You know, and just to follow up on that, your book, Trudy, I think makes it clear that on really crucial public policy issues, Medicare, for example, or Social Security, that in fact the range of debate is clearly warped to suit certain special interest needs. I mean, there's a strong political effect here if this doesn't change. Is that right?
Absolutely. I would say most people in the country are not interested in privatizing Social Security because they understand what will happen if the stock market doesn't perform and people end up with very little or nothing to live on. I think they understand the importance of this bottom layer of retirement security protection. But I don't know that that is really coming through in the debate. And I would also venture to say that most people don't really want to revamp Medicare. Medicare,
you know,
works pretty well.
We've got our last caller on the line. It's a repeat caller who wants to respond to his responses. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to disagree distinctly with your characterization of BBC and of NPR. BBC is clearly anti-Israeli, pro-Palestinian, pro-Arab, and it's outlook and its perspective. It does give Israeli spokesmen an opportunity to respond from time to time, but it has a clear bias, and it itself...
You know, caller, I think I'm going to have to, unfortunately, the band has started in the background, which means they're trying to edge me out of the studio. We'll be back on this issue in coming weeks, including next week we'll have our guest Jim Hightower, and I hope you'll join us then, all of you. I'd really like to thank Trudy Lieberman, the author of Slanting the Story, The Forces That Shape the News, for being my guest today. I'd also like to thank Norman Solomon, author of The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and I'd like to thank Ben Scott, my producer. Stay tuned. The next 2 hours, we'll have the graduation ceremony on WILL AM 580.